Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present The LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Let me just introduce myself. My name is Deborah Freeman. I'm Lyndon LaRouche's national spokeswoman. And on behalf of Mr. LaRouche's presidential campaign and on behalf of Executive Intelligence Review, I'd like to welcome you to today's seminar. As I think most of you know, this seminar is also being broadcast live on the internet. Mr. LaRouche will be addressing us from Europe. He is currently in Germany. We will take Mr. LaRouche's presentation, and then we will be taking questions. I think that most people here in Washington know that Lyndon LaRouche is the only economist in the United States or internationally who has been consistently right in each and every one of his published forecasts over more than 30 years. Today, it is our intention to make available to you what I think will be a history-shaping presentation from Mr. LaRouche, who is known worldwide, not only for his work as a physical economist, but as the founder and still a contributing editor of Executive Intelligence Review, and of course, as someone who is the first declared candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States in the year 2004. This is Mr. LaRouche's fifth webcast since the November 7th election, and it's my expectation that he will address the urgent measures that have to be taken by our government and by governments around the world to avert a catastrophe brought by the onrushing financial, monetary, and economic collapse that we face today. I want to point out to you that really since September of 1999, when Lyndon LaRouche, as a presidential candidate, conducted the first dialogue here in Washington with labor and civil rights leaders from across the United States, speaking of the immediate effects that we would suffer here in America from the unraveling of the financial system, the fact is that hundreds of thousands and indeed millions of Americans have suffered as a result of the fact that those warnings were not heeded. As Mr. LaRouche has pointed out repeatedly, there really is nothing that can prevent a total collapse of the current system. In late June, when Mr. LaRouche spoke to members of the Russian State Duma in Moscow, he told them that the collapse was inevitable, but that the world economy could still survive and grow if leading nations came to their senses and launched a new monetary system right now, modeled on the old Bretton Woods system. The fact is that what we see around the world is we see nations in the process of breaking, often in complete disgust, from the current policies of the Bush administration. And it's a moment which is ripe for key leaders in the United States, for key Democrats in the United States, who hopefully by now have learned the lesson that should have been learned during the course of Al Gore's bid for the presidency. The fact of the matter is that the failure to actually respond when Al Gore moved in Arkansas to steal more than 53,000 votes from Lyndon LaRouche probably was, in the end, far more than anything that happened in the state of Florida, responsible for putting George Bush in the White House. But with that said, we are in a situation right now where the present world financial system is coming down, and it's coming down fast. The world is clearly ready to welcome a fundamental correction to what are now pitiably discredited policies coming out of the Federal Reserve and its chairman, Alan Greenspan. Today's webcast is intended to serve as an opportunity for leading political figures in the United States, representatives of the Washington diplomatic community, representatives of the diplomatic community in New York, as well as for citizen activists, to join together in taking up the vital issues that Mr. LaRouche will address, and to do so in a public dialogue. It's an excellent opportunity to actually engage in a discussion with one of America's leading statesmen and the only political economist who has accurately defined the nature of the unfolding crisis and presented the urgently needed policy solutions. Without any further introduction, it's my pleasure and my honor to introduce to you Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you, Deborah.
We are now in the depths of a systemic financial crisis that, if war does not break out between now and the end of the year, or if there are not assassinations of key figures from among international leaders during this period, by the end of the year, purely and simply, the present financial system will have collapsed, and the present monetary system as well. It cannot be stopped. We're at the end of the system. What we can do is we can save the economy at the price of sacrificing the existing system. What we must do is similar in some respects to what Franklin Roosevelt did in 1932-33 in running for president and being elected and inaugurating a general recovery from the policies of Calvin Coolidge and his types. That is, we must go back to the principle of the general welfare, recognize the system has been rotten, it's failed, it's produced misery. If it were to continue, there would be no hope for the nation or the world. And therefore, we have to go back to principles that had worked previously, as Roosevelt did. And Roosevelt got us through the 1930s and got us through the war years. Roosevelt also had a plan for the post-war period. Unfortunately, he died before the war ended. And therefore, the things that he would have done in many parts was not done. For example, Roosevelt was absolutely committed on the record at the close of the hostilities to eliminate from this planet all vestiges of Dutch, Portuguese, British, and French colonialism. That was not done when he died. Truman, together with Churchill's friends, and restored colonialism. The Dutch conducted a war in what we call Indonesia to restore colonialism. The British sent Japanese troops in to reoccupy Indochina, to hold it for the French, to restore colonialism there. The intention to free India was postponed 1 year with very serious consequences as a result of that, and so forth and so on. But nonetheless, what Roosevelt did continued to the degree that we had in the relations among the United States, Western Europe, Japan, to some degree South and Central America, and so forth. We had a post-war system that worked. It was called the Bretton Woods system. It was based on fixed exchange rates. It was based on capital controls. It was based on credit controls. It was based on exchange controls. It was based on financial controls. And was based on low interest rates, that is basically between 1 and 2% prime interest for international long-term loans. Through that system, up until the middle of the 1960s, Europe prospered and the United States prospered as a result of helping Europe. Some nations of South and Central America benefited significantly from that system, despite the abuses which occurred under it. However, after the death of Kennedy, the assassination of Kennedy, and after the introduction of the Vietnam War, and after the appearance of the Wilson government in England, changes were made in the world system which led to a disaster, such that we can say that as far as relations between the Americas and Europe, Americas and Japan, during that period, it worked with all the shortcomings. What we also say is that since 1967, it has not worked. Therefore, what we have is the wrong system. We had a system which from 1945, to the end of the war, to the middle of the 1960s, worked for us who were part of the system. We've had a system since 1967, since Harold Wilson pulled down the pound in November of 1967, and since the dollar followed with a collapse in March of that next year. Since that time, we've had a system that does not work and has never worked. In 1971, Nixon destroyed the system by going to a floating exchange rate system rather than the fixed exchange rate system. Under Carter, we destroyed pretty much everything that Nixon had not destroyed. And the U.S. economy has been going down ever since. For example, if you look, as we've mentioned before, if you look at the condition of life of the lower 80% of U.S. family income brackets, the conditions of life today are far worse than they were in 1977. Since Carter became president, we've had consistently a tragedy in terms of the conditions of life of our people, particularly those in the lower 80% of family income brackets. We've lost our railroads. We've lost our transportation systems. We've lost our industries. We've lost our power systems. We've lost our medical system. We've lost our health care system as a result of a measure that Nixon put in with the help of Moynihan at the beginning of the 1970s, the HMO system, which destroyed the Hill-Burton system that worked so well for us. So we have been destroyed by policies and by a philosophy of policymaking, which has ruled us for 35 years. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the people in Washington and New York and London decided they had an opportunity, a free hand to rule and loot the world. And the rate of destruction of the world's economy has accelerated since 1989. What should have been a triumph for cooperation among two systems that had been at each other's throats and now had a chance to cooperate was turned into a folly. So we don't have a cyclical crisis. We don't have a system that has problems such that when it goes down, it will bounce back. There will be no recovery from this system under this system. As long as the IMF and its present policies continues to be in authority, as long as the current policies of the U.S. government continue to reign, as long as Wall Street and the Federal Reserve System continue to reign, there is no up for anyone in the United States, not even George Bush, who may not be president for long, if he just some days gets disgusted with his inability to function and quits. Now, part of the problem is the fact the system is no good. It's been no good for a long time. But economic systems are funny things. For example, they don't collapse all at once at the moment you make bad policies. For example, in the case of long-term infrastructure investments, in the terms of education policies, it takes a generation to educate a child, to develop a child into a functioning adult. It takes a generation, or about 25 years or so, to realize the full benefits of infrastructure policies. 10 to 15 years to see an investment program and industry work out and balance out, so that you don't see the effects of bad policies immediately. You see the effects down the line, when the failure to make certain investments catches up with you, when allowing certain industries to collapse catches up with you, when you let the agricultural system collapse and it catches up with you, when your rail systems collapse because you didn't maintain them, when your power systems collapse because you didn't maintain them, all in the name of deregulation. Then later, down the line, the bad policies you made 10, 15, 25 years ago catch up with you. And then all at once, you're faced with a terrible crisis. And silly people say, don't worry, it will bounce back. There's always an upturn after a downturn. It's always that way. Don't talk about a depression. You'll talk us into a depression. Even if you know the system is collapsing, lie. Say you believe it's going to go up. Because maybe if you say you believe strong enough, maybe the system will go up. That's the kind of insanity you hear around you these days. Lies. All right, the system is finished. Under the present system, under the present policies of the United States, economic policies, under our infrastructure policies, under every policy proposed by the Bush administration, this nation is going to hell and most of the world with it. So those things have to be changed suddenly, and we have to go back to a standard that worked. Because you can't change things all at once. You have to take, from past experience, take those things that worked and use those as a model for the policies you want people to quickly adopt. We're going to have to do that. That's why I say we have to go back to a Bretton Woods model of the type we had during the period 1945 to middle of the 1960s. Only this time, instead of just having the United States, the Americas, Western Europe involved, we have to bring the entire world into a cooperative system of that type. Now, we have a good chance. As some of you know, I was just in Russia. I was invited to lead the testimony to the Economic Commission of the Russian Parliament, the Duma, which is a committee that is headed by one of the leading economists of Russia, Sergei Glazyev. And we discussed these things there, as we had discussed these policies earlier. You may have observed that President Putin of Russia has been busy lately. He was in China, where he negotiated a new agreement among a group of nations, which is called the Shanghai Cooperation Council. That Russia and India and China, other countries, are working together to build a new system of cooperation in Eurasia. Russia is reaching out to Eastern Europe, to Germany, to Italy, to France, with partners in Europe, to create a Eurasia-wide system, which will include things such as magnetic levitation railway systems, sooner or later connecting Rotterdam in the Netherlands to Shanghai. Already, the Chinese government has committed itself to build magnetic levitation rail system from Shanghai city to the airport. A similar plan is in existence between Beijing, the capital of China, and its airport. There's also an intention to extend that system to connect Shanghai to Beijing. There are other large-scale transportation systems planned across Eurasia. There's an intention to develop corridors of development through large-scale infrastructure development across Eurasia. Japan is negotiating with Russia on developing a bridge from the mainland of Russia to the northern islands of Japan, to Sakhalin, down into Japan. We have the possibility now of connecting Busan, the southern part of Korea, to the mainland, main islands of Japan. We have, if we get peace in the north, as is being sought by the president of South Korea, with North Korea, the railroad system of Korea will not only be linked together, but will be connecting to China, and will be connecting also to the Trans-Siberian Railroad Network. So you will begin to have the emergence of systems of transportation and development along those corridors from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean across Eurasia. This is a part of the world which dominates the world's population. China's who knows how many billion now. It's 1.2, 1.3 billion people or more. India is now over a billion people. Pakistan is a large country. Bangladesh is a large country. The nations of Southeast Asia, this group of 10 in Southeast Asia, are planning to cooperate. Japan is interested in cooperation with the nations of Southeast Asia. Korea wants to be part of that cooperation. And so what is at foot now is nations such as around a triangle of India, China, and Russia. Systems of cooperation throughout all Eurasia are in the process of being built or already established and been developed, which will transform this planet. Now, what does that mean? If we create a new Bretton Woods system, by doing that kind of reform, we can save the economies. But we need a lot of growth. How are we going to get growth? We have to have a system of low-cost credit on long-term so that we can produce, sell, and deliver to countries that need high technology for their development, for their people. on the 25-year term, that sort of thing. We will now turn countries which are now going bankrupt, like the United States, like the nations of Western Europe, Germany, France, Italy, nations that are going bankrupt in the West. The United States is a bankrupt nation. Don't kid yourself. Don't believe a thing O'Neill tells you. He's either lying or he doesn't know what he's talking about. This nation is bankrupt. South America, look what's happened there. Just think back 10, 20 years. Think about the nations in Central and South America used to consider independent and powerful nations in their own right. Mexico, for example, not the same. Panama doesn't exist anymore. Ecuador doesn't really exist. They close it down. They call it dollarization. Colombia is destroyed. Venezuela is on the way to be destroyed. Peru was marked for destruction. It was being destroyed before Clinton left office. Argentina is disintegrating. Brazil is on the chopping block for disintegration. Chile's ready for a financial collapse. Bolivia is in trouble. Paraguay and Uruguay in deep trouble. Look at Africa. Africa is a case of genocide condoned by the United States and conducted by the British and people in the United States. It's pure genocide. This is not an error. These are not local wars. This is intentional genocide. For example, the former president of the United States, George Bush, the father of the present Bush, in that collection of family trees, is in partnership with a former prime minister of Canada, who's involved with a firm called Barrick Gold. They're sitting in part of Congo, where they have diamonds and there's a lot of gold. And they're looting that area for profit and maintaining their looting with the aid of private armies. Throughout Africa, private armies owned by large multinational corporations, and including people like British Commonwealth figures like Mulroney or U.S. figures like Bush, are engaged in witting genocide against the peoples of Africa for the purpose of trying to make a profit out of stealing their raw materials and reducing the population. That's the situation. So we have a rotten world, but we have all these people in China. They wish to grow. They need to grow. They need infrastructure development. They need technology. They've got some technology. They've got some good technology, but they need more of it. Because they have a lot of people, and a lot of poor people, and a lot of interior regions that need development. India is a somewhat different case, but it has a similar need. Africa, we could do something about if we had something going in Eurasia. I've had plans on this for years. There are plans that will work and can work if Africa is given a chance. What we have to do, in addition to creating a system that works, like the old Bretton Woods system between 1945, the middle of the 1960s, we have to have a program, a development program, an economic development program, of the kind that Franklin Roosevelt represented in his time. We have to take a mission, say a 25-year period, and we have to say, what are we going to do for humanity during the coming generation of 25 years? What we should say is we are going to rebuild our industries to produce the kinds of products that are needed in parts of the world that need the kind of things we ought to produce. And we're going to create a system of credit, not money lending, but credit, where they can come to our store and on credit buy what they need today to build the future for tomorrow. That relationship can be the security of the next generation of our people. It's also true for Europe, Western Europe. Russia is in between. Russia is a peculiar nation. It's a nation which is the only really Eurasian nation of the world. That is, since the Russians freed themselves in the 15th century from the last vestiges of Mongol occupation, Russia became a nation which was European on the one side, but also Asian. It's the typical Eurasian nation. This nation has several links to Southeast Asia. One, it has a middle area of Asia, which poorly developed, but with some vast resources. It has water resources, which are underdeveloped. If we make a connection from Europe, as by rail links and other links, across Eurasia to China, down to India, into Japan, and so forth, this means that we will open up the last real big frontier of this planet for development. This is an area with rich natural resources, but they're not rich unless you can develop them. To develop natural resources, you require infrastructure. You require the technology. With the cooperation among Western Europe, Russia, China, India, and the other countries of Asia, we can do that. And the United States should be a leading partner with that kind of effort. And with that kind of effort by the United States in cooperation with the nations of Eurasia, we will have the power, the economic power on this planet, to bring justice to areas like Africa and rebuild Central and South America. That should be our program. Now, the problem today is twofold. First of all, we have a government that doesn't work. We don't seem to be able to elect presidents that are worth anything recently. We had a choice between Gore and Bush, and both were equally disastrous in different ways, but both were a disaster, a sure disaster. Why can't we choose a person for president who's qualified for the job? Why can't we select someone for president who's not trying to please the suburbanites who are now going bankrupt because their internet investments are collapsing? Why don't we have a president who meets the needs of all of the people and their posterity? Why don't we choose one on the basis of that kind of selection? One who is committed to all of the people and posterity, to the nation, and one who's competent to do the job. Why do we keep picking people who are dedicated to the wrong purpose, dedicated to a particular interest, not the people, nation as a whole, and people who aren't even competent to do an incompetent job? As this, what's happened is this. The governments in Western Europe are not too good these days. They're not like de Gaulle. They're not tough people like Adenauer in Germany or the people we had in Italy and so forth. These are pretty poor governments, maybe not as bad as the one we have in Washington right now, the presidency we have in Washington right now, but they're pretty bad.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
One of the things that bothers the world and threatens the world is that not only do we have a crisis, but we have a situation now which is worse than if this crisis had hit while Clinton was still president. Let me be frank about this. You may have your criticisms of Bill Clinton, but while Bill Clinton and Bob Rubin, his Treasury Secretary, were on the job, and if you had a crisis hitting the world and the nation, such as the crisis hitting the United States right now, and we're in a collapse phase, don't kid yourself, there's not going to be a bounce back on this one. There is no recovery in sight under the present policies. It will never happen. We can have a recovery, but you're going to have to change the policies. But under Clinton and Bob Rubin, they might not have had the ability or willingness to take the measures needed to deal with the problem, but at least you would have had someone in charge who would have responded to the fact that we have a crisis. They might have made a mess of it, but at least they would have tried, and people would have a sense that there's somebody in the White House who had the brains to recognize the problem and at least was going to try to do something about it. We have a situation now, the worst financial crisis in modern American history. worse than anything we experienced in the 20th century. And you have O'Neill, Bush's man. We're not going to do anything about it, they say. Bush, the most underestimated man in the White House. We're not going to do anything about it. We're just going to go on with our program. We're going to stick to our program, says Bush. And the Europe reacts the same way. You have, in a sense, the most powerful nation on this planet, the United States. And the president isn't worth shucks. Now, that's not merely an indictment of the presidency. That is a problem for the world. The world has trouble putting itself together. The United States has become has been a dominant power in the world for some time, especially since World War II. The world looks to the United States as a willing partner to talk to about the common problems among nations and expects the United States to respond with some degree of understanding and competence to the fact that there's a crisis going on and do something about it. And you've got a presidency now that doesn't care. It just plain doesn't care. And if it cared, it'd probably be worse because it doesn't know what to do and it'd probably do the wrong thing. This is demoralizing the world. We're in a very dangerous situation. As I said before, if a war breaks out or one of several key leaders of nations in the world is killed, assassinated in the coming weeks and months, then you might have an incalculable situation in the world where we couldn't tell exactly what was going to happen. For example, right now, you have Ariel Sharon, the present dictator of Israel, who is committed to a war in the Middle East. It's not because there's some issue there. It's because he has a policy of going for war, a policy of killing people. And there are people behind Sharon, if he were assassinated, who are much worse. Worse people. I'm even afraid that he might be assassinated, in which case something might be unleashed in the Middle East that's worse than Sharon. What do you say? We've got all these nations in Europe. You've got the government of the United States. Can't they do something to influence the Israelis to stop making this war? Not George Bush. Won't do it. Oh, he might make a few noises, but he's not going to do anything. They had a discussion at the so-called G8 meeting at Genoa where these people floating on a ship while there were riots going on in the city. They didn't do anything. They said they were going to do something, but they didn't do anything. They just watched the riot and said, maybe we won't have any more of these meetings. That's the situation. You have a sense of the world's going to hell and no one's in charge. So the issue here is, where in the United States are we going to find somebody who represents the role that the United States must play? We've got some good things going in the world. I've been involved in this. I've been dealing with people in foreign countries, in many parts of the world, influential people, people who make and shake policy. We have policies that can be accepted and will work. We have to have somebody in the United States who represents that policy. Forget who's president right now. Someone who represents that policy around which people in the United States can unify to say the United States needs this policy. And says that to the people in Europe, says that to the people in Russia, says it to people in China and so forth. Under those conditions, we can reach agreement. For example, in the new Bretton Woods system, we have leading politicians in Italy, who members of government, senators and deputies, who have supported me publicly, internationally, on a resolution to have a new Bretton Woods system, that is a return to the old Bretton Woods system or something like it. That exists. But we need something in the United States. There are many Democrats as leaders who I respect as persons. But right now they're not doing their job. The Democratic Party has no clear leadership. When Lieberman, Senator Lieberman, who was the vice presidential candidate with Gore, is sitting in the middle of the biggest economic crisis the United States has faced and says it's not the economy, it's the culture. We've got to join the moral majority, he says in effect. When Democrats line up behind that kind of leadership, you say nobody's paying attention to reality. There is no leadership. We had a fight on this that was still going on this D.C. General Hospital. The healthcare system of the United States is being destroyed systematically. That means people are being killed. You kill the healthcare system, you shut down public hospitals, you do what's being done with the HMOs, you are killing people. You are killing Americans systematically, calculably. Don't say it's good policy. Don't say it's necessary free trade or this or that. It's murder. And we're doing it. Americans don't like that. We got a lot of support for the D.C. hospital. We had members of the Senate, other members of Congress who supported it, Democrats and others. But then suddenly they backed away and left D.C. General hanging, saying, well, it's a done deal. There's nothing we can do about it. And people are dying as a result of that. Now, I have a lot of personal regard for some of these Democrats who backed away. But they are not showing leadership. Leadership does not mean waiting until you're elected to be president to lead the people. Leadership means seizing the issue and mobilizing the people, mobilizing politicians, mobilizing others as a political force to get our government to take the action that our government must take. Government is leadership of the people. It comes from leadership of the people. And that's where we stand. Now, what's the danger, the biggest danger at this moment? First of all, if what I've proposed is not done, I can guarantee you that either we're going to be in a war by the end of the year, or you're going to see a depression beyond what most of you believe possible, an economic depression and chaos. But there's something worse than that. And let's look again at this Israel situation. Don't try to understand the problem in Israel and the Middle East from the standpoint of the Israelis or Arabs. That's not where the problem lies. The Israelis are the Israelis, and the Arabs are the Arabs. But they are not the cause of the great danger which may come out of the Middle East war. The problem is this. Call it the Guns of August. Now, if you look back into the 20th century, you'll recall that in August of 1914, a great world war began. A war that could be seen coming, that was planned by most of the great powers. The first planner of the war was Britain. The British monarchy planned World War I. Not the Germans, the British monarchy. The British monarchy got an agreement with the French, got an agreement with the Russians, and conducted some Balkan wars to heat the story up, and got World War I started to stop economic cooperation throughout Eurasia. It was a horrible war, and Europe has never fully recovered from the effects of that war to this day. Then, in August 1939, as the 1st of September approached, the Wehrmacht under Hitler moved to launch World War II, which was also another geopolitical war, to destroy the possibility of cooperation in Eurasia. Now, we have the possibility of cooperation in Eurasia. You look at the agreements, which I've seen, which some of you should have seen, the agreements among China, among Japan, discussions with Japan, India, and so forth, Russia, other nations, you see that there's now a thrust for cooperation in large-scale projects and trade projects which will build up Eurasia, which will really start a world economic recovery. Somebody wants to stop it. August is now approaching. For various reasons, August is a good month to start a war in Eurasia. And we're on the edge of a war. The war is not coming from the Israelis. war is certainly not coming from the Arabs, who don't want any war. The war is being orchestrated by people chiefly in the United Kingdom, Australia, and the United States. There are people here who say, if we do not, the only way, remember, Zbigniew Brzezinski is one of these people. Brzezinski has said the only way to prevent China, Russia, India, and so forth from cooperating in Eurasian economic cooperation is to do what? Is to start a war between Islam and the West. And how do you trigger such a war? You trigger it by getting a religious war started in the Middle East. That is, if the war in the Middle East explodes, as it's about to explode, it could explode on Sunday. If that war explodes, and let's suppose that Sharon is assassinated by some Israeli madman in the process and blames it on some Arabs, then the madmen who will take over in the heat of battle in Israel will not hesitate to use weapons of mass destruction against targeted cities such as Damascus, Baghdad, and Tehran, which are already targeted. If that were to happen, it would happen in the context of an Israeli seizing of the mosque site in Jerusalem, you would have a general religious war, which would rage in repercussions throughout Eurasia and could destroy Eurasia and lead to incalculable results. There are some people in powerful positions in the United Kingdom and in powerful positions inside the United States who want that to happen. These people include Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has stated his position on this repeatedly. And therefore, what you need at this point is we need a movement for leadership inside the United States which says we in the United States are not going to tolerate this. People who will not think out as they did on the D.C. General Hospital fight. People who will not think out as they did on the question of putting caps on energy prices. Who will not think out on the fight to restore a regulated system of energy supply in the interest of general welfare. I assure you that if the United States, if a movement in the United States emerges around that idea, it will have support in other parts of the world. And if the United States puts some serious political muscle behind the determination to avoid that war, it can be stopped. The guns of August can be stopped. Look at the history of European civilization during my lifetime, which is significant. We've had two world wars which have almost destroyed civilization in each case. We're now in a situation where the world economy has been destroyed. The economy of the United States has been largely destroyed by the system which is now operating. The economies of Europe destroyed, of South America, Central America, are being either destroyed or being destroyed. Civilization is in danger. And now we come again to the point that August is coming, and the threat of a new war, this time perhaps a religious war, is about to break out. It's time in the United States that some of us step forward with me and say, we're not going to let it happen. And I think that if the American people see the kind of leadership that will not capitulate, as too many otherwise good Democrats capitulated on D.C. General, as too many good Democrats capitulated on repeal of the Voting Rights Act of 1964, as they did in 2000, that the world will pay attention. And I know the world. They'll pay attention. And I'm getting a lot of heat from around the world on me personally. Please do something about your country. And I'm appealing to you right now to help me do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Let me start with a couple of questions that we have from the United Nations. Lynn, the first question is from Ambassador Osiris Blanco. He is the ambassador from the Dominican Republic to the United Nations. His question to you is the following. The collapse of the world financial system, according to your point of view, is inevitable. How will this collapse affect world leaders' commitments for poverty eradication and sustainable development in the least developed countries over the course of the next 15 years?
Well, there is no commitment to do anything to help the development of the poorer, relatively poorer countries or their populations right now. It doesn't exist. There may be some people who have well-meaning on this, but there is no program. Look, under the conditions imposed on nations by the IMF and World Bank, for example, as long as nations accept the current directives and influence of the World Bank and IMF, either directly or upon financial agencies. That is, if there are some countries that, some agencies that would be willing to help countries with programs, but then they find that they are not allowed to do that unless the program that they are willing to support meets the approval of the standards of the IMF and World Bank. So as long as these policies remain, the present IMF World Bank policies remain, there is no chance of any significant public program involving the present leading countries of Western Europe, the United States, and so forth, to help any of these countries. There's no hope. It would look, to be realistic, remember that the policy changes which were introduced 35 years ago were motivated largely by people who said the population of the world is too large, is growing too rapidly. We have to stop economic programs which foster births, which foster population growth. We have to stop programs which keep old people living longer. We want them to go when their useful years are used up. Cut those programs out. Look what happened. For example, 1973, that great Democrat Moynihan, who was then working as a member of the Nixon crew, Nixon government, who was key in pushing through the cancellation, repeal of the Hill-Burton Act by the HMO bill. Now, anyone who sits down with a pencil and paper and knows anything about demographics can tell you that that change in policy, which people are now screaming about HMOs, but that policy was put into effect back in the early 1970s under the Nixon administration and with a large role by Pat Moynihan, a so-called great Democrat. We called it benign neglect. We called it racism then. But now he's a great Democrat. Maybe the party changed. Right? This kind of policy, like many other policies, were aimed to keep down the population by economic means. You want to kill people? Don't shoot them. That costs bullets. Do it with a sharpened pencil. Do it with budget cuts. Do it with austerity programs. Do it with cutbacks. Do it with policies like the current HMO policies. Do what they're doing in Washington, D.C. to try to reap a multi-trillion dollar bonanza in Washington, D.C. by moving out Negro removal with the aid of shutting down D.C. General Hospital and investing in a high-rise glory with all the bankers and their law firms in there coming down and making riches on the speculation on real estate with the help of the Federal Reserve System and Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae and so forth and so all these other fellows who do that kind of thing. There is no intention in the present system to keep people alive. There's an intention, as in Africa, to reduce the population of Africa massively. That's why it's happening. There's an intention to reduce the population of Central and South America. That's why it's happening. So we should have no illusion that until we change the system, we're not going to get any improvements. Everyone says, but can't you work within the system? That's like saying, how do you work for good inside the Nazi SS? Work within the system. That's our problem. We have to have the will. We have to have the alliances. We have to have the forces that have the power to say, this stops now. Roosevelt did that in 1933. He did it. It wasn't perfect, but he did something. He changed things for the better. Our job now is to assemble ourselves, both in countries and among countries, to change things for the better. That's the only chance. With us inside the system, there's not a chance.
Question is from the Mississippi House of Representatives. This is a question from Representative Eric Fleming. He's a Democrat who represents District 72 and obviously a friend. His question to you is the following. Mr. LaRouche, a U.S. State Department official came to Jackson, Mississippi last month to discuss events in Russia. I asked him a question about the Eurasian land bridge and its progress. He stated that the land bridge was not making any progress, and it was still only in the discussion stage. He cited two reasons why there was no progress. One, that Russia's economy could not support the development of such a project, and two, that Russia's relationship with Japan would have to improve, especially over the issue of the islands that they control and Japan wants. Would you please respond to that assessment given by the U.S. State Department?
Well, let's take the Japan side first. I think we have some people from Japan who are in the audience who have some knowledge of these matters. Actually, things have gone fairly well in the negotiation between Japan and Russia and on this particular business, and particularly in the idea of building a bridge from the mainland Russia to Sakhalin and thus down into Japan. Now, Japan needs that policy. Why? Well, as anyone who lived during the period of World War II as an adult remembers, the problem that Japan faces is it's an island country with very little of the land area usable for its people, that is, for normal habitation. Therefore, Japan, modern Japan, depends upon being able to earn the raw materials imports and related imports it requires for the needs of its people. To do that, Japan has to become a high technology country primarily, and to export the technology products to other countries, especially in Asia, which these countries need in order to secure supplies of the raw materials, food, and so forth that it requires. Now, for Japan, the area which is, it has two areas to go to. One is south, which is to Southeast Asia. And that also, to some degree, includes China. China is a very important customer for Japan. Then also, it means Russia. Now, Japan is sitting there looking across Siberia, which is a land which is full of raw materials potential, vast resources. These resources require development. Now, Russia, because of the beneficence of George Bush, the old one, when he was president, the Russian economy was ruined by George Bush. And I don't think the young one is capable of repairing the damage. But in any case, as a result is people who could go from, for example, from Moscow as Russians to Irkutsk can't do that by train anymore because the whole system was wrecked by the U.S. and British advisors who came in with their little IMF and similar kinds of controls. Russia, therefore, needs assistance, and it needs to expand its production in order to restore and integrate Russia itself. In order to do so, it has resources in these areas, which Japan requires. To tap these resources for Japan's need and Russia's needs requires cooperation between Japan and Russia, such as developing transportation links. Hence, Putin, who is not exactly as stupid as some other politicians these days, made a deal with Japan, as with Shanghai, with other countries. You're seeing coming together, contrary to a State Department official, State Department officials these days come cheap, I think, who not very poorly and not well informed. And that's a going operation. What we have to be afraid of, there are threats to assassinate Putin from people who are more sympathetic to, shall we say, the Bush-Thatcher line in policy. They don't like what Putin is doing. And Berezovsky, for example, has threatened to have Putin out of the way come soon. So there are assassination threats against President Putin to try to stop this. The State Department has expressed not unsympathetic attitudes towards such a change in policy. Brzezinski is much more vehement on this thing. The idea that there should be any cooperation among Japan, China, India, Southeast Asia, the State Department is against it. And the more successful it is, the more the State Department will try to discourage it. So what could I say about the State Department official? Well, he either didn't know what he's talking about, which wouldn't surprise me, or he was lying, which also would not surprise me.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.